Another Saturday night at the Vancouver Institute. We have a very good crowd today, and I think we're going to have a lecture today very central to what the Institute is all about, namely exchanging and ideas on a Saturday night. Remember that the Vancouver Institute is an organization which not only thrives with ideas, but it also thrives being nurtured by the people who come here on Saturday nights. We are very pleased that we do not have to charge for lectures. We value all our participants, whether they pay or not, but we want to make it very easy for people to feel good about the Institute, and we have the desks outside. The purpose of joining is not to gain any special advantage. The purpose of joining is not so that you can come here before 8 o'clock and look behind the bar and say, we're members of the Institute and you are not. The purpose, because there are many people who are members of the Institute who actually sit in the back. Some of them perhaps like to catch a little bit of sleep after dinner, but today you won't be able to do that because we're not planning to turn the lights off today. The speaker has said he will notice anybody who is actually visibly sleeping in the back. So we urge you, as you go out today, to express your love for the Institute voluntarily by seeing the people in the hall and making this very small, very contribution that we ask of people so that we can continue to bring lectures every Saturday night here. Well, with that commercial over, let's get on with the treat. Tonight, we have Professor Dominic LaCapra. You've read that he is a professor of intellectual history at Cornell University. He came there originally from New York and via Harvard, the canonical route, but he has had long association with Cornell and has written many important books there, an outstanding teacher. He's already given 4 lectures, very well-received lectures here as a Cecil and Ida Green lecturer at the University of British Columbia now. And he comes here tonight to speak on a very important topic, important at this time, perhaps important for all time, and it is history and memory, the shadow of the Holocaust. I urge you to join me in welcoming Professor Dominic LaCapra.
Good. Okay, this one is down. Fine, thank you. I'll have to begin by confessing that I'm a non-paying participant at this point, but what I'm going to do tonight is to present a somewhat shortened version of a much longer paper, and I'll focus on problems that I think are especially difficult in the interpretation of the Holocaust. What I would look upon as really knots in understanding, and some issues that really have not been addressed very adequately so far. And I'll really get to that sort of almost midway through the lecture, what I think are the really, what people are trying to do now, that is to say, to do the history of perpetrators, and then also to try to provide some analysis of perpetrators in the Holocaust. And this is really a very recent development in Holocaust studies. But I'll talk at first a little bit about the problem of memory. Recently, the concern with the problem of memory itself has become so widespread and intense that one is tempted to refer to fixation and to take a suspicious view of developments. In certain of its forms, the preoccupation with memory may indicate a failure of constructive will and divert attention from the needs of the present and the necessity of attempting to shape the future. One particularly dubious phenomenon is the nostalgic, sentimental turn to a partly fictionalized past that's conveyed in ingratiating, safely conventionalized narrative form. Indeed, the immersion in memory and its sites may at times have the quality of junk Proustian schrammerei. But the recent turn to memory may have more than a symptomatic value, at least when a concern with memory includes a desire to be attentive to the problem of history insofar as it bears on the present and future, including the need for a self-critical examination of one's own implication in the problems one treats. Memory, including its lapses and tricks, poses questions to history. insofar as it points to problems that are still alive or invested with emotion and value. Ideally, history critically tests memory and prepares for a more extensive attempt to work through a past that has not passed away. One obvious reason for the recent turn to memory and its relation to history is the importance of trauma, notably including the deferred recognition of the significance of traumatic series of events in recent history, events one might well prefer to forget. And there's even developed the rather curiously named field of trauma studies recently, with a focus upon trauma and a return to psychoanalysis, especially in attempting to understand better problems in and around traumatic experiences. The traumatic event has its greatest and most clearly unjustifiable effect on the victim, but in different ways, it also affects everyone who comes in contact with it, perpetrator, collaborator, bystander, resistor, those born later. Especially for victims, trauma brings about a lapse or rupture in memory that breaks continuity with the past, thereby placing identity in question to the point of shattering it. But it may raise problems of identity for others, insofar as it unsettles narcissistic investments, self-images, desired self-images, including with respect to the Shoah, the image of Western civilization itself as the bastion of elevated values, if not the high point in the evolution of humanity. Now, are we getting an echo effect here? And it's because it's because of this?
Maybe. Let's see.
Okay.
Let's see.
Well, we can do away with this, and I can make do with this one if you want to do that. That might be easier, no? Is that what? Yeah.
Let's try that.
Okay, good. Is that better or worse? This doesn't seem to be broadcasting at all. This is not on. This mic doesn't seem to be on at all. That's Is this mic working now? No, the mic is still not working, is it? So we don't have a mic that's working.
Is that working back there? Can you hear that back there?
Yeah, I'm not sure that was the mic. I think it was his voice. So we need a test here, a critical test. But I don't really think this mic is working. It's not working as a mic. It's not working as a mic. Huh? Let me try this again, putting it a little bit down further and seeing if that eliminates the echo effect. Now this was working. Yeah, this is good down here. Huh?
On the side.
That's all right. It'll be like, okay. This is good, isn't it?
Yes.
Yeah. Okay. Good. Yes. Another technical problem solved by a humanist. an important reason for the intensity of the recent interest in testimonies as special sites of memory and trauma is, of course, the advanced age of survivors and the feeling that time is short before living memory of the Holocaust by its victims will itself be a thing of the past. An equally pressing concern is created by the role of negationists and revisionists who attack the validity of that memory and deny or normalize the abominations of the Hitlerzeit, foremost among which is, of course, the Holocaust itself. Figures such as Robert Faurisson are able to appeal to extremes in denying the excesses of the past, for they may turn either to hyperbolic neo-positivism that demands absolute verification to establish the mere existence of gas chambers, or to equally exaggerated relativism that affirms the ultimately fictive, subjective nature of all narrative and interpretive schemes. One of the forces behind the turn to memory is the threat posed by negationists and the wish-fulfilling desires or demands they satisfy, a threat that looms ever larger to the extent that survivors with primary memory of events pass from the historical scene. Before proceeding further, I'd like to indicate very briefly the way certain historians have recently addressed the problem of memory and its relation to history. One very important tendency is to dwell, at times excessively, on the danger I evoked in opening the discussion, the danger of an obsession with or fixation on memory. One has here a kind of meta-obsession, or obsession with the problem of obsession. And this, I think, illustrates the famous dictum that every day, in every way, things are getting meta and meta. You find this meta-obsessional tendency in the recent book by Eric Gonon and Henri Rousseau, Vichy and Passé qui ne passe pas. But this book is rather complicated, and I really don't have time to address it. What I'll do is to turn briefly to an article that encapsulates some of the crucial dimensions of their book, especially the more thought-provoking ones. This is an article by Charles Mayer, someone who teaches at Harvard. Charles Mayer's article, A Surfeit of Memory? Reflections on History, Melancholy, and Denial. And you can find this article, if you're interested, in the journal History and Memory, Volume 5 of 1993. And if you don't know History and Memory, it's a very, very interesting journal that's been coming out for about the last 10 years, edited by Saul Friedlander, whom I'll talk about in a while, Dan Diener, and other scholars in Israel. Mayer quickly removes the question mark from his title by arguing emphatically that there has indeed been a surfeit or excess of memory in the recent past, specifically among intellectuals and particularly about the Holocaust. Here's a quote. It's apparent that in the last few years, the intellectual's fascination with memory continues unabated, not just with the times past that we seek to remember, although historical retrieval has also become a culture industry, but with the act of remembering itself, with its psychic phenomenology, unquote. Mayer tends to pathologize the turn to memory, as do Gonon and Rousseau. He writes, I believe we have, in a sense, become addicted to memory, memory addicts. I think it's time to ask whether an addiction to memory can become neurasthenic and disabling. At the least, we should ask what characteristics of our time may have helped to bring about this indulgence, unquote. Here, of course, one might pause over the attempt to follow an admittedly impressionistic judgment about a surfeit of memory with a pathologizing gesture that sees it as obsessional and then leads to an attempt at causal explanation, a very dubious sequence of thinking. I would, however, prefer to focus on what I think are the more genuinely constructive and stimulating aspects of Mayer's argument. At least for the most part, because it readily becomes apparent that Mayer is preoccupied not simply with a quantitative excess of memory that signals a morbid preoccupation, but with a specific quality or kind of memory to which he objects. Indeed, the memory that upsets him is itself something one indulges in with bittersweet melancholy. It's the chocolate-covered Madeleine of the psyche on which one overdoses. Memory, in this phenomenological sense, presumably gives direct access to experience, often vicarious experience, that may be sacralized or seen as erratic, notably the traumatic experience of victimization. And this is, I think, as I indicated in my first talk, a problem in Lanzmann's Shoah, where I think there is a desire on the part of the filmmaker to identify with the shattered life and the traumatic experience of the victim. Thus construed for Mayer, memory involves fixation on the past that inhibits action in the present, oriented towards a more desirable future. In a sense, it preempts the possibility of a forward-looking politics. Moreover, Mayer, like some others, for example, Peter Novick at the University of Chicago, is particularly concerned with the questionable functions of Holocaust commemoration for American Jews, in which the liturgical viewing of Lanzmann Shoah has played an important part. And I think this is interesting at the present time that you have Jewish scholars such as Charles Mayer and Peter Novick raising questions about certain uses of the Holocaust in identity formation for American Jews. And what you have here is, I think, a rather interesting general phenomenon which isn't restricted, I think, to Jewish culture, and that is to say the way in which a traumatic or incredibly shattering series of events becomes a basis of identity rather than a way of raising the question of identity. It actually becomes an aspect of identity formation, which is rather interesting and paradoxical. And this, in a sense, happens, in all myths of origin, if you read myths of origin. Okay, here's Mayer talking about this. There has been from time to time another function or subtext of Holocaust commemoration. It served to impose a certain unity on the Jewish community in the United States. Like the loyalty oaths that professors had to sign in the 1950s, the Holocaust Museum implies a bland statement that establishes a group cohesion not by imposing stringent codes, but precisely by calling for a pledge of allegiance that seems so undemanding that only the really disloyal could object. Still Mayer, to pose an alternative heuristic question, why not a museum of American slavery? Would it not be a more appropriate expenditure of national land and funds to remember and make vivid crimes for which our own country must take responsibility rather than those perpetrated by a regime which, in fact, Americans gave their lives to help destroy? Or why not a museum of American Indian suffering from smallpox to wounded knee and the alcoholism of the reservations? Of course, the affected groups might not want this sort of museum. If we polled spokespersons for African Americans and American Indians, they might prefer a museum which integrated the proud moments of their history and culture with its moments of victimization in some linear or historical order. Why does the new Jewish museum center on the catastrophe? And why is it this catastrophe and not the slave auction block or Andrew Jackson's ethnic cleansing of the Cherokee that's remembered on the Mall?" Unquote. The force of Mayer's questions is not eliminated by the fact that the Holocaust Museum in Washington does indeed include other victims of Nazi oppression, such as homosexuals and, quote, gypsies, and it also exhibits the unwillingness of the United States to change immigration laws or take other steps to assist victims of Nazi oppression during the Second World War. Nor should one be diverted from the questions Mayer poses by the hyperbolic aspects of his account, his own exaggerations. And here's one example of the more exaggerated dimension of his argument. And I quote, "In fact, modern American politics, it might be argued, has become a competition for enshrining grievances. Every group claims its share of public honor and public funds by pressing disabilities and injustices. National public life becomes the settlement of a collective malpractice suit in which all citizens are patients and physicians simultaneously." Well, enter Rush Limbaugh. This is what I call the Rush Limbaugh effect, which is, I think, something one has to worry about when one is criticizing certain tendencies. What I'd like to do instead is to conclude with Mayer's thought-provoking political argument, which he tries to derive from his earlier comments. And he says, "The surfeit of memory is not a sign of historical confidence, but of a retreat from transformative politics." And this is, I think, a viewpoint that's shared among a variety of different groups. It testifies to the loss of a future orientation of progress towards civic enfranchisement and growing equality. It reflects a new focus on a narrow ethnicity as a replacement for encompassing communities based on constitutions, legislation, and widening attributes of citizenship. The program for this new ethnicity is as symbolic as it's substantive. It aspires preeminently to the recognition by other groups of its own suffering and victimhood. Finally, it cathects to landscape and territory because territoriality has been abandoned as a physical arena for civic action and is nurtured instead as an enclave of historicism." Unquote. This critique, which reminds you a little bit of certain writings of Jürgen Habermas, who argues for a kind of constitutional patriotism that is not simply restricted to identity politics, this quasi-Habermasian critique of memory may be fruitfully related to other critiques of narrow identity politics, such as those found in Judith Butler or Paul Gilroy. In my judgment, it incriminates not all concern for memory, or even some fantastic quantitative surplus of memory, and it certainly doesn't eliminate the importance of sustained investigation of the Holocaust. What I think it does is to raise a question about a certain kind of memory that may indeed be politically diversionary and self-indulgent. Mayer's critique serves as a reminder that another kind of memory is more desirable, memory requiring the kind of memory work Freud referred to as working through. Memory, in this sense, exists not only in the past, but in the present and future tenses. It relates acknowledgement and critique to the attempt to get beyond the past towards a more desirable future and to re-engage in life and life's problems. The kind of memory I'd see Mayer as cogently criticizing is itself locked in a sheer dichotomy or binary opposition with history, on the one hand, or on the other hand, a kind of memory that's at times simply conflated with history, rather than implicated in a more problematic but mutually questioning relationship to history. Other historians in the recent past have indeed anxiously opposed history and memory, or, in a more minority tendency, approximated history and memory, if not identified the two. In the first instance, which is the more important, I think the more important tendency in the recent past among historians has been to oppose history and memory, to see memory as in some sense the antithesis of history. And you can find this in a number of very important historians, such as Pierre Nora, in his edited volumes entitled in French, Les Lieux de Mémoire, and they're being translated now, the first volume is translated, Studies of Memory Places. You find it in Yosef Yerushalmi Zakor, the very important book Zakor, where you also have this kind of antithesis of history and memory. You find it in Arno Mayer's Why Did the Heavens Not Darken? And you could mention other people. So the first tendency is, I think, the most prominent one at present. In this first instance, memory is crucial because it is what history must define itself against, whether happily or sadly. Memory, in other words, becomes the antithesis or other of history, and it's seen as very close to myth and liturgy, what critical history is not. In the second instance, which is a much more minority tendency, which you can find, for example, in the recent book of Patrick Hutton, Patrick Hutton's book, History as an Art of Memory, memory's importance stems from its putative position as the ground or essence of history. Memory is then understood as basically the same as history, or at least as the matrix of history. I don't have time for discussion of these tendencies, which from my point of view are largely enemy brothers that feed off one another and really don't pose genuine alternatives. They tend to foreclose certain problems that I think are the more important problems. I'd simply interject here what should be obvious. Of course, memory is not identical with history, but neither is it the opposite of history. Their relation over time may vary, but not as a function of a categorical opposition between them and us. For example, in Pierre Nora, traditional societies, which for him have living memory related to orality, and modern societies, which have history related to writing and the desiccation of memory. This is a very old, indeed, Platonic opposition that someone like Pierre Nora takes up again. The problem, I think, is the problem of the actual and desirable interaction between history and memory, something which is oversimplified by a stark opposition between them. Memory is a crucial source for history and has complicated relations to documentary sources. Even in its falsifications, repressions, displacements, and denials, memory may nonetheless be informative. Not in terms of an accurate empirical reconstruction of the past, but in terms of the way in which the past is often assimilated or received at times in an anxiety-ridden way. For example, to give an example, a prevalent idea among victims and others that the Nazis made soap of Jews is, on the basis of research, empirically false, spread at the time as a rumor by a Nazi official. As one source of the rumor that's been traced, but empirically false. But I think it has a figurative value, both in terms of the very real Nazi tendency to reduce Jews to objects, and in terms of its rather uncanny inversion of Nazi ritual and hygienic anxiety over contamination by Jews. Here, the homeopathic remedy, the quote, poison that in an appropriate dosage becomes the cure, or the putative contaminant that's turned into a cleansing force, is distorted into a bitter irony, as Jews become soap. Moreover, a critically informed memory is crucial in the attempt to determine what in history deserves preservation in living traditions, either as what is to be criticized and avoided, or what is to be expected and valorized, emulated. Conversely, history serves to question and test memory in critical fashion and to specify what in memory is empirically accurate or has a different but still possibly significant status. Even if it's wrong empirically, it may still have a significant status in terms of what it indicates about reception, anxieties, certain telling transformations of phenomena. Indeed, once history loses contact with memory, it tends, I think, to address dead issues, which no longer elicit evaluative and emotional interest or investment on the part of people. One may even contend that history may, I think, legitimately have a ritual component insofar as it's not confined to neo-positivistic protocols, but rather engages, at least discursively, in its own variant of memory work and working through that's embodied in mourning, a process that may be called for, at least for victims of traumatic events. In any case, one's judgment concerning the appropriateness of an historical account, one's very sense of whether or not the language used is appropriate, depends on more than ethical or aesthetic criteria. It touches on ritual criteria. But this, of course, does not mean then that history simply becomes liturgy. It may have a ritual component. In the foregoing respects, one might contend that history and memory have, as I intimated earlier, a supplementary relation. That's a basis for a mutually questioning interaction or exchange that never attains full closure. Memory is both more and less than history, and vice versa. History may never capture certain elements of memory, the feel of an experience, the intensity or joy of joy or suffering, the quality of an occurrence. Yet history also includes elements that are not exhausted by memory, such as demographic, ecological, and economic factors that are very significant. More importantly, perhaps, history tests memory and ideally leads to the emergence of both a more accurate memory and a clearer appraisal of what is or is not factual in remembrance. Just as history goes beyond or falls short of memory, so memory has a comparable relation to history. There may be aspects of memory that have no place in history. For example, aspects of my personal life that do not bear on and may even be diversionary, tendentious, or self-indulgent with respect to a study of the Holocaust. For this reason, I think, the turn to anecdote and autobiography must be carefully motivated if it's not to be dubious. For example, if I were to elaborate them in a certain way or at least provide enough information for others to be able to do so, it might well be relevant in understanding my interest in the Holocaust to know that although I was raised as a Catholic, I grew up in a Jewish neighborhood, had many close Jewish friends, and was a Sabbath goy. It might also be relevant to know that I left this neighborhood at about the time of puberty while simultaneously losing the Catholic faith, losses I experienced as difficult if not traumatic. For a few years following the move, I even returned regularly to my old neighborhood to see my old friends. I now realize that some of the people in that neighborhood in Brooklyn were no doubt emigres from the Nazi regime. Were survivors. Indeed, these aspects of my life might be especially significant in that they involve disruptions, felt losses, and belated recognitions that might be a precondition for becoming sensitive to larger and more catastrophic disruptions in history. Other aspects of my life might be less relevant and of little more than narcissistic interest in a discussion of the Shoah. And I think that often people who take the autobiographical turn don't try to make those discriminations. And what you get is largely a narcissistic approach to a problem, which has very little to do with really analyzing and understanding the problem. These formulations barely begin to scratch the surface of a complex set of problems, but they may be enough to cast doubt on the stark opposition between memory and history and to suggest that the problem is instead their actual and desirable interaction. I'd like to turn now to a book that in its own way engages many of the problems I've touched upon, And the book is Saul Friedlander's, a book I would strongly recommend, Saul Friedlander's Memory, History, and the Extermination of the Jews of Europe, published in 1993. A book that I think is especially important for trying to understand and analyze the behavior of perpetrators. A very difficult and delicate issue, I think. Friedlander provides a thought-provoking sense in which the Holocaust is distinctive or even unique, a much, much debated issue in the recent past. But in fact, the quote I'll give you embodies two contentions that one can distinguish, although Friedlander himself doesn't really distinguish them. He sort of places them in very close proximity. Here's the quote, and I'll say that the first is the first contention. The Nazi regime attained what is, in my view, some sort of theoretical outer limit. One may envision an even larger number of victims and a technologically more efficient way of killing, but once a regime decides that groups, whatever the criteria may be, should be annihilated there and then, and never to be allowed to live on Earth, the ultimate has been achieved. Then the second contention. This limit, from my perspective, was reached only once in modern history by the Nazis. I'd propose that Friedlander's first contention frames his second contention, and even that it makes the most important point. The essential consideration is that an outer limit was reached, and that once this limit is reached, something radically transgressive has occurred, and there's a sense in which comparisons are beside the point. The limit may be reached more than once in history and still remain distinctive or even unique in a specific, very important sense. Whenever that outer limit is reached, something unique has happened. To say that, in fact, the limit was reached only once changes the sense of uniqueness and may even banalize it, notably by prompting either a dogmatic assertion of absolutes, even a grim competition for first place in victimhood, or the type of research into similarities and differences that easily becomes diversionary. Friedlander also notes certain limited ways in which his approach to the Shoah may approximate deconstruction, notably in, quote, the avoidance of closure, the ever-questioning commentary, and the excess carried by the Shoah, unquote. So the avoidance of closure, the ever-questioning commentary, and the excess carried by the Shoah. Without repudiating these family resemblances to deconstruction, Friedlander nonetheless insists on the, quote, simultaneous acceptance of two contradictory moves, the search for ever closer historical linkages and the avoidance of a naive historical positivism leading to simplistic and self-assured historical narrations and closures. In this sense, the critique of closure, totalization, simplistic self-assured narration is not accompanied by what is often imputed, whether rashly or not, to deconstruction. That is to say, an unqualified affirmation of free play, anything goes, and the obliteration of all distinctions, which is the way many people see deconstruction, at times justified by certain people within the tendency, at times not justified. Friedlander's emphasis is rather combined with a search for more comprehensive articulations and forms of understanding that nonetheless remain self-critical and open to contestatory voices, especially to the voices of victims themselves, that the historian's account should be disrupted by the voices of victims themselves, rather than to take these voices simply as objects of analysis or of the account. In this effort, Friedlander finds especially useful such key psychoanalytic concepts as transference, acting out, and working through, as I do myself, and in the recent past, Friedlander and I think you could say, have been working more or less in tandem on these issues. Before turning to these concepts, I'd note that in attempting to elucidate what he calls, echoing Freud, the unease in historical interpretation, which is the term that's translated as civilization is discontent, the Unbehagen, is the unease in historical interpretation, the excess, in other words, the excess and the blockage to understanding embodied in the Shoah, Friedlander quotes and comments on a section of what has perhaps become in the recent past a proof text of Nazi ideology, and in certain ways of important currents in modern thought more generally. I'm referring to Heinrich Himmler's 1943 Posen speech to upper level SS officers, to the top brass of the SS, that constituted the audience of Himmler's Posen speech in 1943. Friedlander looks to this speech, the speech by Himmler, as a way of elucidating the Unheimlichkeit, the strangeness or uncanniness of the Shoah, and the manner in which it presents the historian with, quote, some imponderables which indeed seem to escape us, included in the overall notion of Rausch in German. And Friedlander translates Rausch as elation, but it could also be translated as intoxication, delirium, or ecstasy, an important mode of excess. Moreover, he notes that, quote, for further analysis, we would need a new category equivalent to Kant's category of the sublime, but specifically meant to capture inexpressible horror. And this is what, in my book, Representing the Holocaust, I refer to as the negative sublime. And the sublime always has a strong element of negativity, but in the negative sublime, the negative is accentuated. Okay, I'll quote a longer portion of Himmler's speech than Friedlander does, and interject a few comments, then I'll come back to Friedlander and what he quotes from the speech. And I don't know if people know this speech, but you can find at least a translated selection of it in the collection of Holocaust documents edited by Lucy Davidovits. Okay, here's the section that I am quoting here. And this is Himmler. I also want to make reference before you here in complete frankness to a really grave matter. Among ourselves, upper-level SS, this once it shall be uttered quite frankly, but in public we will never speak of it, the code of silence in the SS. And then now he's going to refer to the so-called Night of the Long Knives, the purge of Erich Röhm and the SA leadership. Just as we did not hesitate on June 30th, 1934, to do our duty as ordered, to stand up against the wall comrades who had transgressed and shoot them. Also, we have never talked about this and never will. It was the tact, which I am glad to say is a matter of course to us, that made us never discuss it among ourselves, never talk about it. Each of us shuddered, a kind of aesthetics of shock, rather prevalent at the time. Each of us shuddered, and yet each one knew that he would do it again if it were ordered and if it were necessary. I am referring to the evacuation of the Jews, the annihilation of the Jewish people. And here, evacuation and annihilation are separated only by a comma at this point in Himmler's mind. This is one of those things that's easily said. The Jewish people is going to be annihilated, says every party member. Sure, it's in our program, elimination of the Jews, annihilation, we'll take care of it. And then they all come trudging, 80 million worthy Germans, and each of them has his one decent Jew, seinen anständigen Juden. Sure, the others are swine, but this one is an A1 Jew, ein prima Jude. Of all those who talk this way, not one has seen it happen. Not one has been through it. Keiner hat es durchgestanden. Most of you know what it means to see 100 corpses lie side by side, or 500, or 1,000. To have stuck this out, and accepting cases of human weakness, to have kept our integrity, or decency, anständig geblieben zu sein, that is what has made us hard. I'd simply, before continuing, point out at least three things here. Integrity. What did Himmler mean by integrity? Not stealing things from the Jews. Doing nothing for your personal benefit. Killing, in a sense, out of purity of intention, without any personal benefit. The notion of Nazi hardness. Nazi hardness is produced by sticking out or enduring scenes of mass death while maintaining one's integrity, holding together unspeakable antinomies of existence. And then finally, it's interesting to note that Himmler himself became upset, showed human weakness, when he first saw the executions of the Einsatzgruppen in Minsk. On some accounts, he vomited. On others, he fainted. And then the following statement, the very famous statement, which is often quoted, "In our history, this is an unwritten, never-to-be-written page of glory," the Shoah. "In our history, this is an unwritten, never-to-be-written page of glory. For we know how difficult we would have made it for ourselves if today, amid the bombing raids and the hardships and the deprivations of war, we still had the Jews in every city as secret saboteurs, agitators, and demagogues. If the Jews were still ensconced in the body of the German nation, we probably would have reached the 1916-17 stage by now," unquote. I've commented on these passages in my book, and I won't repeat what I said there. I'd simply add that in the uncanny spectacle of a negative sublime, as described by Himmler, one has a kind of initiatory, radically transgressive, potentially traumatizing limit experience for Nazi perpetrators, a kind of unspeakable rite of passage involving, I think, a quasi-sacrifice, victimization, and regeneration through violence. The portion of Himmler's speech that Friedlander quotes is as follows, and he translates certain sections a little bit differently than I did, or than Davidowitz with a little bit of change did. "Most of you know what it means when 100 corpses are lying side by side, when 500 lie there, or 1,000. And in Kantian terms, this is a kind of mathematical sublime, this increasing numbers that can go on in geometric progression. "Having borne that, and nevertheless, some exceptional human weaknesses aside, having remained decent, has hardened us. All in all, we may say that we have accomplished the most difficult task out of love for our people. And we have not sustained any damage to our inner self, our soul, and our character," unquote. Friedlander traces the horror and uncanniness of these lines to two sources. First, an inversion of values related to the dissonance between breaking the most fundamental of human taboos, wiping from the face of the earth each and every member of a specific human group, and the declaration that this difficult task was being accomplished satisfactorily, without any moral damage. So the first thing, extreme transgression with no moral damage. A genocide, in a sense, that is beyond good and evil. And then the second point that Friedlander wants to make, why this is in some sense uncanny, the awareness that what is for Himmler and elite SS the most glorious page in their history must remain secret and unwritten because it will not be understood by future generations, the uninitiated. Friedlander further notes that Hitler's unquestioned obsession with anti-Semitism is not apparent in the case of Himmler and his Posen audience. More important for Himmler, at least here at Posen, were the bond with the Führer, the so-called Führerbindung, the bond with the Führer, and the Rausch, the elation at excess. One may, I think, supplement Friedlander's account of the Rausch by reference to a 1988 collection of documents entitled "The Good Old Days," in quotes, "The Good Old Days, the Holocaust as seen by its perpetrators and bystanders," edited by Ernst Clay, Willy Dressen, and Volker Ries. And this is, again, a book I would strongly recommend people to read, "The Good Old Days." The phrase, "the good old days," "die schöne Zeiten," comes from a caption in a private photo album kept by the notorious Kurt Franz, for a time a commandant at Treblinka. For Franz, the good old days were the days in the death camp. Among the photos is one of Franz's dog, Barry, which he used to set on prisoners with a command that inverts the status between canine and Jew. His command was, "Man, grab the dog." The legend of the photo tells us that, quote, Barry tore many Jews to pieces, on numerous occasions biting off their genitals. And Barry, by the way, is not a Doberman or a pit bull. He's a rather sweet, family-looking Saint Bernard. We've perhaps become overly accustomed to accounts of Nazi horrors, but the good old days is, I think, especially disturbing for the way its documents mingle extreme cruelty with kitsch sentiment, notably in the letters of German SS and Army personnel to beloved wives and sweethearts at home. Also noteworthy is the elated carnivalesque atmosphere that often surrounds the killing of Jews for both perpetrators and bystanders, including Army personnel on furlough who apparently would at times just go around to watch the spectacle of Jews being beaten to death. The scenes of laughter and cheering are particularly chilling. But the quotation that serves as legend to the photo of the so-called death dealer of Kaunas in Lithuania, a handsome young blonde man leaning on a club that's almost as tall as he is, reads, "Each time a victim was beaten to death, they started to clap." The report of a German Oberst, army colonel, notes, "At first I thought this must be a victory celebration of some type of sporting event because of the cheering, clapping, and laughter that kept breaking out. When I stepped closer, however, I became witness to probably the most frightful event that I had seen during the course of two world wars." As U. Trevor Roper observes in his foreword, in Kaunas, Lithuania, where Einsatzkommando III operated, the Jews were clubbed to death with crowbars before cheering crowds, mothers holding up their children to see the fun, and German soldiers clustered around like spectators at a football match. At the end, while the streets ran with blood, the chief murderer stood on the pile of corpses as a triumphant hero and played the Lithuanian national anthem on an accordion. Unquote. This scene is extreme but not atypical of other incidents documented in the book. Such scenes might lead one to conclude that Himmler underestimated the capacity of those outside the upper ranks of the SS to appreciate, indeed to share his sentiments. It's worth observing that the good old days is important in its own context as a politically and ethically significant act of memory. The dust jacket of the book informs us that Ernst Klee is a teacher, filmmaker, and writer. Willy Dressen, deputy director of the Central Bureau for the Judicial Authorities of the German Länder, and Volker Ries, an historian. The collaboration of three Germans from different professional and occupational areas is indicative of the cross-disciplinary resonance and the entry into public consciousness of the memory of the Holocaust as a political and cultural problem in Germany, something which Habermas, in 1986, during the historians' debate, insisted was necessary and to some extent has indeed happened, I think, in Germany, especially among younger people. This book marks in a process that took the often covert or repressed private sentiments concerning the Shoah and the official public representations or avoidances of it that typified the immediate post-war period and brought them more or less dramatically and disturbingly together, typically through the literal mediation of the media, spectacle, and consumer culture. The good old days is one of the most thought-provoking and genuinely searching instances of this uneven, very uneven, and at times contentious process that included many other phenomena, such as Joachim Fest's film, really rather dubious film, Hitler, A Career, of 1977, the broadcast of the American television series Holocaust in 1979, Edgar Reitz's 16-hour television epic and film Heimat of 1984, and of course the historian's debate itself of 1986. I further note that certain implications of the good old days for understanding perpetrators, or at least analyzing perpetrators, are both further substantiated through extensive archival research and carried to an interpretive extreme in the recent book of Daniel Jonah Goldhagen, Hitler's Willing Executioners, Ordinary Germans and the Holocaust. And I'll just say a few words about what most of you must know as a very, very contested book, which has caused reams of commentary, including on the web. Goldhagen tends to reverse Hannah Arendt's notion of the banality of evil and to propose a new rendition of the Sonderweg, or special path view of German history, by presenting Germans as steeped in a national tradition of anti-Semitism that prepared them to participate voluntarily, even wholeheartedly and almost mystically, in the state-sponsored, malicious, cruel torture and killing of Jews. For Goldhagen, I quote, "The Holocaust was a sui generis event that was enabled by the long incubating, pervasive, virulent, racist, eliminationist anti-Semitism of German culture." And, quote, "It was only in Germany that an openly and rabidly anti-Semitic movement came to power, indeed was elected to power, that was bent upon turning anti-Semitic fantasy into state-organized genocidal slaughter," unquote. I tend to agree with Goldhagen's view of the legitimating role of culture and ideology, that culture and ideology played a very important part here, although his own understanding of culture and ideology is, I think, narrowly, even jargonistically, social and scientific. I also agree with his critique of the reduction of anti-Semitism to a dependent variable. The attribution of primary or even exclusive explanatory force, as many historians are prone to do, the attribution of primary or even exclusive explanatory force to bureaucratization or the industrialization of mass murder, and the restriction of deep-seated anti-Semitism to a small elite of fanatical Nazis. I think Goldhagen is right in questioning all of these tendencies. Indeed, Goldhagen adduces extensive evidence to show the prevalence of anti-Semitism in Germany, and he assembles crucial information on perpetrators in work camps, death marches, and police battalions. But unfortunately, he's tendentiously fuzzy on the importance of the comparative point that anti-Semitism was virulent in other nations or areas, and on the specific relation of anti-Semitism to other factors in explaining the Nazi rise to power and the Holocaust. Moreover, he goes beyond even his extensive evidence. He has a very good case in certain respects, but he exaggerates it to the point of ludicrousness. He goes beyond even his extensive evidence, both by failing to analyze counter-tendencies to anti-Semitism in Germany and by generalizing about German society as a whole in a manner that allows for only rare exceptions to what he terms, quote, "the ubiquity of eliminationist anti-Semitism in Germany." He also repeatedly invokes eliminationist anti-Semitism as an ultimate explanatory category, and often dichotomizes between voluntarism and the explicit threat or actuality of external coercion. And external coercion or force was typically not present in the police battalions that did involve relatively ordinary Germans. He thus can account for the disturbingly ambiguous status of certain extreme phenomena, which are in a sense both imposed and accepted. They're not either voluntary or forced. They're in some sense both imposed and accepted. The more complex workings of ideology or his own emotional response to problems. Indeed, his inability to elucidate further the nature of, quote, "eliminationist anti-Semitism" and the brutally victimizing, cruel, elated, and often mockingly carnivalesque behavior attending it, leads him to translate into the concept of political culture what seems close to a stereotype of Germans as anti-Semitic. In other words, political culture in his work comes very close to an updated version of national character. And it's interesting to see that happen with the concept of political culture. It becomes like a stereotype of national character. And to generalize myself, I think Goldhagen's interpretation is both rashly generalizing in applying to virtually all Germans and very thin on an interpretive or explanatory level with respect to what I think is nonetheless some very important evidence that he adduces. And I think it's worth reading the book for the discussions of the work camps, which he argues, I think convincingly, are not that different from death camps, the crazy forced marches, which we can talk about if you like, and the police battalions, where the basic work had already been done by Christopher Browning, of course. Of Rausch in the Nazis, Friedlander himself writes, and I quote, Could one of the components of Rausch be the effect of a growing elation stemming from repetition, from the ever larger numbers of the killed others? Most of you know what it means when 100 corpses are lying side by side, when 500 lie there, or 1,000. This repetition, and here indeed we are back in part at Freud's interpretation, adds to the sense of Unheimlichkeit, uncanniness, at least for the outside observer. There the perpetrators do not appear anymore as bureaucratic automata, but rather as being seized by a compelling lust for killing on an immense scale, driven by some kind of extraordinary elation in repeating the killing of ever huger masses of people, notwithstanding Himmler's words about the difficulty of this duty. Suffice it to remember the pride of numbers sensed in the Einsatzgruppen reports, the reports of the mobile killing squads. The pride of numbers in Rudolf Höss's autobiography, The Commandant of Auschwitz. Suffice it to remember Eichmann's interview with Zassen. He would jump with glee into his grave knowing that over 5 million Jews had been exterminated. Elation created by the staggering dimension of the killing, by the endless rows of victims. The elation created by the staggering number of victims ties in with the mystical Führerbond. The greater the number of the Jews exterminated, the better the Führer's will has been fulfilled. Unquote. The Eichmann evoked in this statement is not Hannah Arendt's, nor does he resemble the Nazi officials in Claude Lanzmann's Shoah. As Lanzmann himself intimates in an interview, perhaps the point is that the banality of evil may apply to the personalities of individual perpetrators, but not to the unimaginable deeds these mediocrities performed. One may recall as well Freud's notion of the repetition compulsion, which he related to the death drive and to endless acting out of traumatic scenes. Compulsive acting out of traumatic scenes. With reference to Friedlander's earlier mention of the sublime, one might suggest that the sublime itself seems to involve at least three components: rupture or blockage of some sort, for example, rupture or blockage of understanding or of mourning, a potentially traumatizing excess or flooding of the system, for example, of anxiety, terror, or at least something beyond understanding. In Kant, the apprehension of what one cannot comprehend. And excess. And elation. Elation, perhaps, at surviving the risk of rupture, or perhaps for some other unfathomable reason. Here, I think one has the importance of the near-death experience and of extreme risk. If the foregoing analysis is accurate, it would seem that for Friedlander, the historian's account somehow repeats, perhaps with a difference, the anxiety-producing rupture and excess active in the object of study. And for me, this means that, in a sense, the historian's account must transmit a muted form of trauma, that the trauma must register in the historian's account. That is why complacent, harmonizing narratives are simply out of place here. But for Friedlander, I think correctly, the historian resists or recoils at elation in the Shoah. And this is another quote from Friedlander. However, precisely at this point, the elation created by the dimensions of the killing, our understanding remains blocked at the level of self-awareness, and this after the events and because of these events. So at the point of Rausch, empathy ends. There is no empathy at this point. There's a recoil. As the British philosopher Alan Montefiore put it very aptly, the unimaginable belongs to that part of my darkest imagination, or at least that imagination which, whether it be mine or not, I may have to recognize within me, to which my whole conscious, normally sensitive being refuses the very right of existence. Thus, the greater the moral sensitivity, the stricter the repression will be of a subject deemed too threatening to both the individual and society. The historian can analyze the phenomenon, a negative sublime involving Rausch, from the outside, but in this case, his unease cannot but stem from the non-congruence between intellectual probing and the blocking of intuitive comprehension, unquote. This is very interesting about the problem of empathy in history, which many historians have written about. The possibility and then the limits of empathy with respect to certain phenomena. I think one may supplement Friedlander's account with the argument that the unease provoked by non-congruence should be conjoined with an explicit act of critical distancing and an attempt to check acting out and the repetition compulsion, as well as to counteract the fascination of certain extreme phenomena. This checking depends on critically framing and working through problems by appealing to informed memory, judgment, and responsible agency. The inability to recognize oneself, at least potentially in Himmler, may derive from insufficient insight into the self, to what may be radically disorienting or even blinding if it's seen. In other words, it may, as Friedlander intimates, be due to repression or even to the denial of the other within the self. But an awareness or recognition of the other, to the extent it's desirable, in no sense entails affirmation or acceptance. On the contrary, it requires vigilance and the mounting of conscious resistance to deadly tendencies that are fostered but never simply determined by certain historical conditions. My comments imply, and I should mention here that that I think almost all of post-romantic aesthetics and certainly contemporary thinking of aesthetics tends to be focused around the problem of the sublime. The sublime is very important in aesthetic theory at the present time, and I think has been since the Romantics. But it's often not put into relationship with phenomena we prefer not to look at. And what I'm trying to do is to bring out another dimension of the sublime, not to implicate all of sublimity, but to indicate how the sublime might have had a certain fascination in phenomena with which we would not want to identify. Okay? My comments imply that one way to see the sublime is as involving, and this is, I think, interesting and worth thinking about more. My comments imply that one way to see the sublime is as involving a transvaluation of trauma, an attempt to transvalue trauma that brings to the subject an experience of elation or rausch. My comments also indicate the need for discriminating among modalities of the sublime and recognizing the temptation and the threat of possibilities that should be met with active resistance. Especially questionable, I think, is the imminent, what you might call the imminent or desublimated sublime, related to victimization, regenerative violence, regeneration through violence, and a deranged quasi-sacrificialism, which is, I think, one form of the sublime, which has been very important historically. And we can talk about this more if you want. Friedlander, at least, implicitly links the sublime and the unheimlich or the uncanny, as do many, many other people. And in fact, in the last 20 years, there's been a kind of rash of interest in the sublime and the uncanny, taken together in tandem. Friedlander, at least, implicitly links the sublime and the unheimlich, the uncanny. Yet he doesn't discuss their relation to the return of the repressed. One may argue that sublimation in Freud involves a movement beyond the senses into, quote, higher spheres in which otherwise repressed erotic or destructive energy is converted into works of civilization. In this sense, sublimation counteracts the return of the repressed and is a domestication or territorialization of the sublime, an attempt to render it less uncanny through either some form of dialectical elevation or more plausibly through some form of displacement. More disconcertingly, Freud saw the uncanny as the once familiar that was defamiliarized through repression and that induced a compulsive return to the same place, to the same traumatic scenes. The instance Freud emphasized, of course, was, of course, the uncanny nature of the female genitals associated with the mother's womb as the once familiar but repressed Heimat, home, that became unheimlich, uncanny. Changing registers, I'd suggest that the sacred and religion in general often tend to have a denied or repressed rather than an explicitly displaced, sublimated, and partly controlled position in secular life that may induce an often destructive and violent return of the repressed and disguised distorted, and extreme or excessive forms. Indeed, the figuration of the sacred in many modern thinkers has been in terms of sublime scenes of violence, scapegoating, and victimization. Scenes often involving misogynistic male fantasies or the acting out of intergroup and even interspecies violence, for example, in bullfighting. This is, of course, a restricted view that may say more about modern orientations towards religion than about religion in general. And here I think the work of Georges Bataille is emblematic, both symptomatic and at times analytically critical of these tendencies. As I've noted, one may ask whether the sublime itself may be seen as a secular sacred, as I think in certain ways the sublime is a secular sacred, one that may be associated with a strained attempt to transvalue violence and trauma. In my book, Representing the Holocaust, I not only suggested the role of a negative sublime in at least certain Nazis related to the fascination with excess and radical transgression. I also cautiously speculated that the victimizing excesses of the Nazi genocide were related to a deranged sacrificialism in the attempt to get rid of Jews as dangerous, at times fascinating, phobic, or ritually impure objects that polluted the Volksgemeinschaft, the community of the people. A self-purifying sacrificialism with a very complex relation to racialized biology, eugenics, an aesthetic ideology of totalization or beautiful wholeness, and modes of bureaucratization and medicalization that were also manifest in the Nazi genocide. These things were also important. But I think that race in the Nazis was not a purely biological concept. It was simultaneously bureaucratic and ritual. Moreover, the sacrificialism might be interpreted as a return of the repressed. But such an interpretation would not imply a simple regression to some primitive, pre-civilized, or barbarous state, as Adorno and Horkheimer seem to believe. Indeed, the problem for understanding, the very difficult problem for understanding, would be the disorienting linkage of such sacrificialism to specifically modern conditions, such as bureaucratization, formal rationality, and industrialized mass murder, in which the repressed would return precisely as the repressed, or as what seemed out of place and uncanny. I think it's this conjunction of the modern and the return of the repressed that poses a real knot or problem for understanding. And the idea of regression to barbarism unties this knot in much too facile a manner. The real problem is how seemingly modern phenomena can be combined with a kind of deranged sacrificialism. That's the problem to understand, not the idea that now now we civilized people are regressing to barbarism. That's not the point. The point is the connection of the civilized and something which seems barbaric. Here I'd also note that Nazis, at least some Nazis, may also have resorted to what's been analyzed as cynical reason, an interesting concept, cynical reason. Slavoj Žižek has written of this phenomenon, and I quote, in the critique of cynical reason, published in 1983, a great bestseller in Germany, Peter Sloterdijk puts forward the thesis that ideology's dominant mode of functioning is cynical, which renders impossible, or more precisely vain, the classic critical ideological procedure. The classic procedure was to take the values of the society and to show how the practice contradicted the values of the society and therefore bring a false consciousness to a true consciousness, a pattern that you find in Marx and others. And here the argument is that a newer kind of cynical false consciousness renders obsolete the older mode of ideology critique. The cynical subject is quite aware of the distance between the ideological mask and the social reality. But he nonetheless insists upon the mask. The formula, as proposed by Sloterdijk, would then be, they know very well what they're doing, but still they're doing it. Cynical reason is no longer naive, but is a paradox of enlightened false consciousness. One knows the falsehood very well. One is well aware of a particular interest hidden behind an ideological universality, but still one doesn't renounce it, unquote. I'd resist going to the extreme of postulating the irrelevance of ideology and its critique in older forms involving belief and false consciousness. I think they're still around, and I think they were important in the Nazi phenomenon. But the possible role of cynical reason is an important consideration that may shed light on aspects of the Nazi genocide. One often asks how Nazis could have taken seriously the more idiotic aspects of their ideology, such as the demonized image of the Jew. Moreover, one may well ask how a sacrificialism, however excessive, deranged, or disguised, could possibly apply to victims who are ideologically presented as vermin or filth that was utterly devoid of value. And the problem here, you might say, is the problem of the relation of the discourses and practices of pest control and deranged sacrificialism. How pest control and deranged sacrificialism may come together. And I'd suggest to you that you have a very important prefiguration of this problem in Kafka's Metamorphosis, where Gregor Samsa is both a pest that has to be controlled and someone whose elimination leads to the regeneration of the family through violence. I think there's a very similar problem in the Metamorphosis. And often people think you have to choose one or the other. I think it's really both and here. Here, the notion of cynical reason may be combined with bureaucratic rationality in helping to account both for the way an ideology may be affirmed in spite of an awareness of its idiocy and for the possible operation of a certain kind of sacrificial mechanism. The formula would be, in this case, I know Jews are, according to our ideology, unworthy sacrificial victims, pests, vermin, but I'll sacrifice them anyway. Moreover, cynical reason may well interact with more traditional ideology in a larger constellation. Thus, the Nazi genocide could also be sustained by Rausch, an ecstatic elation in the Führerbindung, the bond with the Führer, with the belief that, in eliminating Jews, one was doing the will or following the sacred orders of the Führer, as Himmler and others said time and time again. The foregoing comments imply that the historian begins with a positive, negative, or ambivalent transferential relation to the object of study, as well as to other inquirers into that object. Transference, or self-implication, is inevitable to the extent that an issue is not dead, provokes an emotional and evaluative response, and entails the meeting of history with memory. When confronting live issues, one becomes effectively implicated and tends to repeat at some level the processes active in what one tries to understand. With respect to traumatic events, and certainly with respect to the extremely traumatic limit event, one must, I think, undergo at least muted trauma and allow that trauma or unsettlement to affect one's approach to problems, to have it register in one account. And as I said, in treating these events, a kitsch, harmonizing, complacent, or fetishistic narrative that denies trauma is out of place, although still quite common. But one shouldn't remain, I think, at the level of acting out or absolutize it in the form of an attempt actually to relive or appropriate others' traumas, even in the case of victims whose traumas, of course, can't be identified with Himmler's reactions. Even if trauma can't be fully overcome, as it may not be for victims of limit events or even for attentive secondary witnesses, it may be counteracted by the attempt to work through problems, mourn the victims of the past, and re-engage life in the interest of bringing about a qualitatively different state of affairs. Working through problems would also involve, I think, an attempt to acquire greater insight into the tangled web I've evoked, the web linking trauma, the uncanny, the sublime, the carnivalesque, the secularized sacred, and sacrificialism, which I think is the web that really historians have not illuminated very much in the massive amounts of work on the Holocaust, preferring other more easily researchable topics such as the eugenics movement, the relation of the eugenics movement to later happenings, bureaucratization of mass murder, the mechanics of the murder, and so forth. In conclusion, and if you'll bear with me for a couple of more minutes, I'll change metaphors and note the role of a tragic grid that achieved a paramount place in the Holocaust, but also is operative, I think, elsewhere in history. It's the grid that locks together perpetrator, collaborator, victim, bystander, and resistor. A grid that also threatens to encompass the secondary witness and historian. A goal of working through problems should be the better understanding of this grid and the attempt to overcome it towards a more desirable network of relations. In limit cases, the perpetrator may be traumatized. And the perpetrator may suffer from hallucinations, nightmares, and other symptoms of trauma. Himmler, as is well known, suffered from chronic, at times incapacitating, stomach pains that his masseur, Felix Kirsten, correctly saw as psychosomatic in origin, although the sources are complex. Often the causes of Himmler's discontent were Hitler's reactions, the reactions of his God, which caused him stomach cramps. But there were other reactions, such as the reaction at Minsk that I referred to earlier. And Himmler's aggressive associate, Erich Vandenbach Zaluski, was prey to hallucinations and nocturnal fits of screaming connected with the killing of Jews and related activities in the East. But perpetrator trauma, while attended by symptoms that may be comparable to those of victims, is ethically and politically different in decisive ways. The denial or repression of that crucial difference is one basis of the projective attempt either to blame the victim or apologetically to conflate the perpetrator or collaborator with the victim, as is the case, I think, in Shoshana Feldman's testimony with respect to Paul DeMond and Primo Levi, the collaborator and the victim, both seen as victimized, or for that matter, in a somewhat different sense, in Ronald Reagan's maunderings at Bitburg, where he tried to make everybody a victim, including SS. The traumas of victims are often a reason for the initial lack of resistance when a mode of aggression departs so far from expectations that it's unbelievable and met with incredulity and a total lack of preparedness, typically the case with Jews during the Shoah. As Freud noted, trauma is attended by an absence of Angstbereitschaft, the readiness to feel anxiety. Trauma, for Freud, always comes with the absence of a readiness to feel anxiety, so that one is overwhelmed and numbed by events that go beyond expectation. I think one of the purposes of studying history, notably the history of the limit case, is to generate that anxiety in tolerable, non-paranoid doses so that one is in a better position to avoid or counteract deadly repetitions. And this is why I think that the conveyance of trauma in muted doses is important in history. The historian must, I think, work out a subject position in negotiating transference and coming to terms with his or her implication in the tragic grid of participant positions. The conventional stance for the historian is, I think, often closest to that of the innocent bystander or onlooker. And I think this is the case even in the very important book of Michael Maris on the historiography of the Holocaust in history. And I think it's a very typical position for the historian who tries to be objective, impartial, judicious, in a sense like an innocent bystander. But this safe position is, I think, particularly questionable in the case of the Holocaust or other extreme or limit events. The most tempting position is probably that of the resistor, with marked sympathy for the victim and antipathy for the perpetrator or collaborator. This stance is, however, too easily taken up, especially by someone who hasn't been tested by events, who hasn't been tested by limit events. It's a very easy pose to take. I think the historian or other secondary witness should attempt to work out a complex position that doesn't simply identify with one or the other of the participant positions. And this is a real problem, discursively. While acknowledging in particular the need to honor the resistor, listen attentively to and respect the position of the victim, or the multiple and variable positions of victims, as well as to appreciate the complexities introduced by what Primo Levi called the gray zone of relations induced by the Nazi policy of trying to make accomplices of victims, the historian, I think, should attempt to prepare the way for overcoming the entire complex of relations defined by the grid perpetrator, collaborator, victim, bystander, resistor, a very important grid in history, I think. These are distinctions whose historical importance one recognizes, but that one does not unproblematically valorize or deconstruct. I think these are distinctions one does not simply try to deconstruct. There's a very important sense in which one deconstructs only what one valorizes, what one values, however ambivalently, such as the texts of Plato, for example. That is a worthy object of deconstruction. The ideological dribble of the early Daman is not something one deconstructs. It's something one criticizes. These, I think, are distinctions marking subject positions that one investigates empirically, analyzes carefully, in certain ways attempts to avoid replicating in one's own voice, and tries to overcome in practice. To the extent it's at all feasible, the purpose of this overcoming would be the generation of a transformed network of relations that counteract victimization and allow for different subject positions and modes of agency, involving, for example, justice and generosity as different forms of subject relations. Working through the past in any desirable fashion would thus be a process, not an accomplished state, and involve not definitive closure or full self-possession, but a recurrent yet variable attempt to relate accurate critical memory work to the requirements of desirable action in the present. And thank you very much for your attention and your patience.
As is our custom, we will now have a question period, and I ask for short, simple questions, not comments.
And I'll try to answer. One of my favorite statements from Adorno is, I'll try to answer in as simple and Hegelian a manner as possible.
Back there.
I find it very hard to understand. Yeah, the question is whether there are studies of narcissism in history or elsewhere, as well as trauma studies, and did Himmler himself have a narcissistic involvement in the Holocaust, and can there be a narcissistic relationship to the sublime, is the question. I think that one of the things that is very clear in Himmler is that Himmler really perceived Hitler as an exalted presence, really a quasi-divine being. And there was, in a sense, a form of narcissistic identification between Himmler and Hitler. And that Hitler was, in a sense, Himmler's superego, the being to whom Himmler always deferred. And there was only a disruption of that only towards the very end of the war, when Himmler was willing to go around Hitler and actually try to negotiate with the Allies for the surrender of certain Jews in return for certain forms of compensation, money or trucks or whatever. One really interesting document, which historians have not done much with, but I don't want anybody to do anything with it because that's what I want to do now, is the memoirs of Felix Kirsten, who was Himmler's masseur. Kirsten was a really very interesting figure who was the masseur of royalty before he met Himmler, and Himmler became very dependent on him and really trusted him a great deal, and Kirsten writes memoirs, and Kirsten is himself a very interesting figure who is honored in Israel as a person who helped to save the lives of many thousands of Jews, because what he did with Himmler was try to persuade Himmler at various points to surrender Jews who were slated for execution. And apparently, towards the end of the war, Hitler wanted to destroy The Hague, and he had Himmler countermand that order so that The Hague was not destroyed. He did a number of things, rather interesting things. And There's an element, of course, of compromise in his life in that he did remain Himmler's masseur, but he really tried to use that position in circumstances. But in any case, what's interesting is that what you have is somewhat typical of the relationship between the patient and the doctor, and the patient becomes reliant on the doctor and confides in the doctor. And many historians simply discount Kirsten's memoirs. The best book on Himmler is that by Richard Breitman, who says that which is very good empirically, but I think provides virtually no insight into Himmler. And one thing that Breitman does is simply dismiss Kirsten's memoirs. But Kirsten's memoirs are a very interesting source, to get back to your question, of trying to understand what Himmler's relationship to Hitler was and what Himmler's investment to Hitler was. Now, in terms of the sublime and narcissism, one could try to elaborate that kind of notion and how one would try to understand the sublime. See, I think that in thinking, there are two tendencies in the sublime which are very, very close to the tendencies they displace in religion. That is to say, there's the notion of a radically transcendent sublime, which you cannot approach, which is unrepresentable, unnameable, and in relation to which the proper relationship is silence. That's, for example, Lyotard, to some extent Kant, although Kant sees the sublime as in some sense transcendent, but believes that the sublime can be triggered by certain scenes in the world, especially scenes of wild disorder in the world. And then the other view of the sublime is the more imminent view of the sublime related to something like sacrificialism and sacrifice. And I think sacrifice is in some sense an attempt to approach divinity, or in the secular world, related to certain forms of excess, radical transgression, and the sublime. So, I mean, in a sense, there are projective phenomena involved there, but there's also a kind of complicated history of the sublime.
Question here.
Fine. I don't know if you listened. Yeah. Yeah. I don't know if you listened attentively to what I said. I think that what I was trying to do was to show how that question is a bad question. I mean, to paraphrase Sidney Carton, it's a far, far better thing to deconstruct certain questions than to answer them. Right? There's a problem in certain questions because they're asking for something that's perhaps misguided. Now, what I try to say is that whenever a certain limit is reached, something distinctive or even unique has happened in history, in a different sense of uniqueness. That's different from a numerical sense of uniqueness, that this happened once or only once, or the idea that these are simply comparable. See, I think that with that kind of question, I think it's important to contextualize answers to that question and to see what motivates the answers. In the case of someone like Ernst Nolte, in the historian's debate, what motivated the idea that the Nazi genocide was just like other genocides was a desire to normalize, to airbrush the Nazi genocide so that it would fade into the misty vistas of history. Now that, I think, is a bad motivation. Other people might raise that question to emphasize the importance of what's going on in Cambodia. In fact, there's a very moving moment in one of the Holocaust testimonies where the woman says, whenever she sees news reports on what's happening to the children in Cambodia, it sends her back into the Holocaust. That, I think, is a good comparison of the two.
Over there? Okay. Question over there? Louder.
Did you say Jewish and Polish?
Jewish and non-Jewish.
Yeah. To my knowledge, I think what he's asking is whether, in my research, I haven't done research on this topic myself, but in let's say in historical research, is there a difference between the children of Jewish survivors and the children of other survivors, such as, let's say, survivors of Gypsies or Jehovah's Witnesses or political dissidents? Are there differences between them? I really don't know of sustained studies of that, and it's really recent that the studies of the survivors, the children of survivors, have been undertaken. There was an extensive study in Germany comparing the children of Jewish survivors to the children of Nazi perpetrators. And this study tried to argue that in many respects the psychological problems of the children of the perpetrators might be more severe because their relationship to their parents was so much more problematic, that they could not value their parents. They were always suspicious of secrets. There were things there that they could not rely on. It destroyed trust. And I think that's another interesting thing to study more carefully, that the children of perpetrators in Germany and how difficult their life is. There's a book that addresses this problem theoretically to some extent, tries to provide certain ideas that are interesting ideas, and then other people are taking up these ideas in more empirical research. The book is this book by Nicholas Abraham and Maria Tarock called The Shell and the Kernel. And Abraham develops the concept of a transgenerational phantom, by which he means something haunting, something that haunts you, which is transmitted across generations, often in relatively unconscious ways, in situations where the parents don't talk about something, but nonetheless something very unsettling is transmitted to the children. And the children are as if haunted by some ghost that they can't even name. And that's a very unsettling experience. And I think that's something that other people like Ilse Gubrick-Semitis is studying now in Germany with respect to the children of survivors.
Yes, there's a question here.
Yes, would you elaborate on the death marches? The death marches were rather fantastic because this is towards the very end of the war when the Germans realize that the war is lost. The Allies are invading from the west. The Russians are invading from the east. And what the camp guards and SS officers have to do, along with their cohorts, is to take the prisoners from camps and to take them to other places which they believe are more secure. Okay, that's the kind of rational motivation. But what happens is unbelievable, because to march 10 miles from place X to place Y, they'll go 350 miles. You know, as if you were going from Boston to Newton, and to go from Boston to Newton, you first went to New York, then went to Washington, then came up to Newton. And this seems just totally crazy. And what happened during these marches is that Jews were vilified, beaten, mocked. And so in many ways it seems that in a sense the purpose of the marches was not simply to get them to another place, but to subject them to other forms of torture in what seemed like a kind of strange dance of the death.
Okay. Other questions? Yes, one here.
Right. The question is there some connection between Paul de Man's role at the time of the Holocaust and his later elaboration of deconstruction? And that's, I think, a really very difficult question. Let me just sketch out what I find to be sort of acceptable on an initial level. That is that, for me, there are different problems in approaching this issue. One is the fact that Paul de Man, at the age of 21 or 22, wrote a series of articles in a newspaper that had pro-German inclinations, collaborationist inclinations, and in at least a couple of cases, anti-Semitic dimensions. Now that to me is probably not very surprising, given Paul de Man, his milieu, the status of his uncle as probably the leading theoretician of socialism in Europe,
who move towards collaboration and the idea that for the nonce, labor should make its peace with the new order. So what de Man did during the war is not, for me, really a puzzle, or even in certain ways a real problem. And in any history of the Holocaust, de Man's role would probably not even merit a footnote. The second thing is the relationship between de Man as a mature scholar, especially when he achieved fame and had many students and had that kind of teacher-student relationship, the relationship between that de Man and the early de Man. And what I think is the case that he did not really come to terms with his past in any public way. I think the incidents that are cited as public reckonings are really not public reckonings, such as a letter he wrote to Renato Poggioli when he was heading the Society of Fellows at Harvard. That was not a public statement. That, I think, is more questionable. And I think that it's hard to understand what was happening there. And I tend to believe that had de Man actually confronted publicly his earlier writings, his status would not have been undermined, it would have been enhanced. Right? And then the third thing is how other people around de Man reacted to that. And that's where I think that this was not deconstruction's finest moment, let's say. That I think many of the people in and around deconstruction did things that were rather apologetic, such as trying to read the early essays of de Man as if they were Plato's Phaedrus or Foucault's History of Madness, which they're not.
Okay.